It's just the three at the bottom here, right? So Python and C#, yeah, both popular and loved. That, I think this is sort of the part of the superpower.
It makes sense.
Of C#, and it's something we're going to work hard to keep at as we try to, as we broaden the addressable audience, so to speak, to make C# stay a desirable language. I also want to call out that we have a number three here as well. It should be familiar to many. F# has a really, really dedicated community, and once you pop, you can't stop, right? So go take a look at F# as well. They also have a category called most dreaded technologies. That's the ones that most people use that would like to stop doing it.
Right. We felt we had to show this, otherwise we would feel. They got the joke. All right. It would have been disingenuous not to show this. So.
Yeah, it would be dishonest not to show this. But to be honest, when we saw this here, we kind of fell off our chairs. Personally, I was very happy. I was even sitting on one. So we were like, what? It's not that bad.
I don't believe this. It says it's more dreaded than Perl.
Yeah, what's up here? So we had to do some thinking, and because it's not just that we're in denial. Well, maybe there's some of that, but when we talk to the VB community, this isn't what we get, right? We don't get that people really hate it and they just want to get out. I think a part of it, at least, is that this is the Stack Overflow developer survey. The people who self-identify as VB developers, they're off somewhere else in a forum that existed long before Stack Overflow, and this is not a theory. We know this to be true. And actually being a happy community over there. And the people who are on Stack Overflow are the ones that love another language, and they go to Stack Overflow to follow that, but they have to use VB despite their desires in the daytime. Maybe it's even VB6, because this doesn't call out VB6 versus VB.net. And you know what? If I was forced to do VB6 in the daytime, and I was going on Stack Overflow at night, dreaming of a better life, you know, I'd probably be on that statistic as well. We think that's part of it. That's part why it's so bad. But we talked a lot to the VB community, especially the last year, and we are realizing that this sort of automatic approach of doing everything to VB that we're doing to C#, just sort of automatically, that doesn't seem like the right approach. VB developers, C# developers, they want different things, right?
Right.
I think VB developers value stability, quality, support. They value awesome tooling. C# developers like those things too, but they're more inclined to want to have new features, to kind of be modern, have the language be modern, to have the language actually, you know, kind of stack up to some of the languages on top of that loved list that we saw before. Okay, so you're going to see us starting to differentiate those two languages more and do things differently with them as we go. But, you know, much as we love F# and Visual Basic, we're going to start talking about C#, because that's a language that's in the title of this talk. This is what I call my rainbow slide. You'll find out soon enough what I mean. Just to remind you of all the things that have changed about .NET and around C#,
yeah.
Just over the past couple of years, right? From being a Windows technology, it now runs everywhere. And we mean more and more seriously everywhere. From sort of at the technological level, from being a system component that everybody sort of had to agree on being pre-installed on Windows, you can now deploy .NET with the app as part of .NET Core, for instance, and do side-by-side, have much more componentized experience. Runs on a VM for sure, but more and more so you can choose to run it, to compile it down to native if that fits with your performance profile and your deployment profile, if you find compiling down to specific architectures. And now to things that are near and dear to Dustin's heart and mine. We used to have black box compilers. Now we have Roslyn, open compiler APIs. Everybody can ask questions about C#, compilers that don't just compile. We have a clicker that doesn't run.
It's not written .NET. In .NET. We heard that.
Yeah,
it's not written with C# anyways.
We like to come back to themes in all the parts of the trilogy. The Roslyn technology itself actually enables this, moving from just being a Visual Studio language to you can write C# in any editor you want. And finally, of course, really a really big point here is that we moved from a proprietary technology to being open source. And so if there's a part of the story that we are not filling out, somebody else will, right? And they are.
Yeah.
This is really important. So talking of Roslyn.
Yeah, let's talk about Roslyn. So you want me to take this clicker? All right. So I do want to talk about Roslyn. This talk is called The Future of C Sharp. Maz and I have done it, you know, done this talk a couple of times now here, and we love coming here and talking about this. But we can't really give the same tired old talk and have it be the future of C Sharp anymore, right? Because Roslyn shipped. We actually did. There was naysayers and disbelievers, and but now we did ship, and now we're coming up with kind of what's next for that. Where do we want to take Roslyn? We're fairly ambitious people. It's, you know, we are. And so we see Roslyn becoming really the C-sharp and Visual Basic language engine for all the things. You know, that's all the editors and IDEs. That's all the linters and analysis tools, the fixers, the refactorings, the code generators, the scripting, the REPLs, anything that deals with C-sharp code and needs to be smart about it, right? It needs to do some analysis or code generation or, you know, any kind of developer tooling. We want to see Roslyn at the heart of that for a number of reasons, right? You know, one of the biggest is that you don't have to, when you go and build your own language engine to do those sorts of, build those sorts of tools, you end up having to chase the language release after release and try and stay caught up, you know, and make sure that, and of course there's the very hard task of just making it correct in the first place, right? It'd be nice to just, much better if you just use the compiler that we provide an open API on top of. And also, as we all kind of, you know, all the community comes and starts working with Roslyn to put it, you know, right in the center of all, at the bottom of all of these tools, the contributions that come back to it make it better. It makes it better for everybody. So this is happening today. You know, Xamarin Studio 6 was a big change. They replaced kind of the language engine they had in the IDE for their tooling for things like code completion and formatting. And today that sits on pretty much on Roslyn as is in Xamarin Studio 6. Also, we partner pretty heavily with some guys and have a project called OmniSharp. You guys heard of OmniSharp? It's a cool project with some very, very smart guys behind it. We're deeply involved with it because what OmniSharp does is it takes and uses Roslyn at the heart of it to kind of process your project and be able to query this little language server to get back, you know, hey, what would I show in the completion list here when I press dot in this particular file, for example? And it has a little HTTP or, you know, standard in and out. You can kind of communicate with it. And then also part of OmniSharp are a number of plugins, right, for different editors that talk to that server. So I can use OmniSharp with Vim, I can use it with Atom, I can use it with Emacs and Sublime Text, and at Microsoft we use it to power Visual Studio Code ourselves in our own IDE experience. And that's something where we're partnering with the community, putting Roslyn at the heart of this system and be able to create some amazing things so that you can take and do C-sharp development anywhere you want to on any platform. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's interesting that the fact that C-sharp runs on Mac and Linux and all these means that we can run Roslyn on them so that we can power IDEs through OmniSharp on those platforms as well. Right? Right. It all comes together.
Right. So as we kind of forge ahead and figure out what we want to do there and how we can contribute ourselves the most, and it's more now thinking about, okay, we created this compiler API surface area where you can ask about C-sharp code. Now it's like, well, let's think about the next level, the higher level APIs, thinking about we need an API for completion lists and that sort of thing. But when it comes down to it, what it really is we want there to be, and this is a statement that Mad said to me, I totally agree with it, so we want there should be only one code base in the world for understanding C-sharp. That's how we feel about it today. So if you're trying to, you know, if you want to go build something that targets C-sharp, get involved with Roslyn and go use that and help us make it better and better, because it will make it better for all of us, okay? So that's what we're
well said,
my
friend.
There. All right. So let's dig in. We've got a few things we want to talk about. First of all, we want to talk about C-sharp 7, lucky number 7, okay? I'm sure you're all excited about that. You've seen a few things here and there, but that's all, you know, a lot of the other talks are just looking at the sausage, maybe just show you a little bit of the sausage. We're going to get really, you know, involved and see how the sausage is made and see, you know, some of the issues with the sausage and perhaps other flavors of sausage, and perhaps I'm taking this too far.
Yeah,
I want to look really briefly at VS Code integration. I talked about how we could take, you know, Rosin and kind of take it everywhere and use it at the heart of other tools. And so I want to look at VS Code. And then we're going to look at some of the ways that we've been taking advantage of Rosin to improve what we call the inner loop, kind of the inner developer loop, which is kind of the features that you use every day when you're writing code, editing code, navigating code, trying to understand a code base, kind of those the features that become part of the things that you do, the tasks that you do over and over again. We want to take a look at some of those features. So,
cool.
You ready to take it away?
Yeah, whoops, we're out of slides, so we better show some code.
Okay.
You want to press number 6 over there?
Sure, we are out of slides. I swear, we are totally out of slides.
So, here's a very interesting C# program. So, C# 7, it's what's next after C# 6. The thinking, we sort of, we have a lot of new possibilities for how we're going to rev the language going forward. And we said, you know what? So we've been looking at a bunch of very interesting language features, and some of them take a long time to kind of design and develop and prototype and get feedback on, and some of them are more quick. We said, we shouldn't have that hold us back from having a higher cadence of releasing the language. So we're going to try releasing C# 7 a little quicker. We're going to put some features out that are ready, and we're just going to keep some. The fact that some of the features that you may be seeing on GitHub is working on, the fact that they're not in there, that may just mean that they're in the next version. Like, okay, so we're gonna up our cadence, or at least try it now, up our cadence on the language and see what happens. So it's going to be slightly fewer features, but it's going to come out quicker. It's going to come out with the next Visual Studio.
Right. So you guys know how some of you have come up to us over the years and said, man, things just coming out too fast.
Yeah.
We didn't listen.
Yeah, we just made it worse.
It's not happening.
Yeah. Sorry, you don't have to upgrade. Oh, wait, maybe you do. I don't know. Yeah.
Let's make it that way.
Okay. So let's, for the next 22 minutes, let's play with some language features. And for those of you who were here for the first part of the trilogy, you saw some of them kind of scrape the surface. I'm going to try to go a little deeper, at least if I can start coding instead of talking. We can get there. So I'm going to give myself some numbers. And yeah, Scott Hunter had some numbers as well if you were here, but mine are going to be better because I'm going to have...
You should start with two.
I'm going to have these numbers
Ooh.
Here. You know, those are real computer numbers. But actually, you know, I only know the first 20 by heart or so. So... I'm going to write them differently. I'm going to write them as binary literals. Just to start with a small feature here, we now have binary literals in C#. So if you really want to show those bit patterns, you don't have to be part of the secret brotherhood of hex. You can just see the bits, right? Okay, so I'm still going strong here. Thank you. But whoa, I'm kind of starting to have trouble counting all the zeros here. So let's put some digit separators in there. That's also something you couldn't do before, but as your numeric literals kind of get big, it's nice to have some kind of separators. And you can put these wherever you want. I just put them at every 4 because you do that for binary, but if I wanted to have about 14 of them right here, I could do that too.
That'd be great.
That really makes it more readable. So, okay, those were some small features just to get us warmed up. Okay, ready for the next trick?
I am. They were clapping for binary literals. You got these guys. These guys are in the palm of your hand.
The people who were not sure they were coming to the session, they're out there in all the restaurants eating all the food. So let's write a function to kind of summarize this array of numbers. We want to know what the sum of them all is, and we also want to count them. So we have to return 2 things. I'm returning 2 ints. What's going on?
You're typing inside a method. That's crazy.
What is this? What's going on? Oh, don't tell me you were at the first talk. You already know. Let's make this a static method so we can call it. That's not.
You're inside a method body, man.
I am. Whoops. Why is this working? Why is it working inside of a method body?
I don't know. I've never seen this.
It's because we have something called local functions as well in C# 7, where you can actually write your helper functions inside of other functions and kind of structure your code like JavaScript, if you will. you decide, it's not so much that I want to pull my helper functions into my functions. It's more like, oh, this is getting a little complicated. I want a helper function oh, now I have to pull it out as a pure function of the one I was already writing, but that means to get all the context that I had out there, I need to pass parameters and all kinds of stuff. If I just write it in here, then I could actually just use the locals that are in scope here, like the numbers local that's here. I'm not going to do that because I'm going to call this method recursively later. But another thing that happened here, so that's local functions, got that? Another thing here is that I am returning two numbers. So this is a tuple. This is a tuple type. We now have tuples in C#. Okay? Yeah. So just to do a dummy implementation here to start with, here's a tuple literal. Okay? It's kind of obvious. You kind of get the general idea here, right? If I go and call my method, let's call tally with the numbers array that I have up there. You see that it returns a tuple. This is going to look nicer in the final bits. Let's grab it. It would be nice if I could actually just have two variables right here and kind of deconstruct or split the tuple back into its component parts. And we're working on that, but I don't have that working yet. We haven't decided on a syntax.
We were talking about it at breakfast, actually.
Yeah. Whereas the rest of this is old bits from last Thursday. Yeah. So.
I should actually mention, we have, our machines up here are almost steaming with the Franken builds we have installed. Some of these bits are in kind of Dev 15, hidden under flags. Some of them are, in Visual Studio 15, rather. Some of them are, built from other places and pulled in. We are going by the seat of our pants, and we might crash and burn, and you might feel slightly satisfied by that.
That's going to be fun. So actually, that's mostly him.
Yeah.
So everything I'm showing you in the language, except for tuples, is in the build that you probably have already downloaded and spent way too much of your mobile allotment on. So anyway, I'm just gonna grab the tuple as it is into T here, and let's print something out. Let's do one of these. This newfangled feature that has been here since last summer. That was presented as a new feature earlier today. And let's just say sum is t dot what actually. So by default, tuple has an item one and an item two. Okay, that kind of works. I'd probably want the other one. And the count is probably the other one. And t dot item two. Okay, what? But it's not. It works, but it's not
very pleasing.
Yeah. So what you can do is, instead, you can go and this is probably the most important part, you can go and give names to your tuple elements. So I can say there's a sum and the count. That doesn't change what the tuple is at runtime, actually. These names are fake compiler names, if you will. So a tuple is a tuple, and it's just based on the types and the sequence. But you can give these names, and what that means is that, not only when I hover, it tells me nicely that one is the sum and the other is the count. But more importantly, if I go to the completion list here, even though you can see item one and item two still working, they're not squiggled, they're hidden now, and I get nicer names that I am strongly encouraged to use instead. Right? So I can say t.sum and t.count, and the compiler just compiles it down to the same thing. But so just the documentation of that and the way the code looks nicer, I think that's an important addition to the tuples that many languages have. Okay, so now you might notice that I'm going to actually implement this method, so don't worry. But you might notice that this kind of looks very similar to a parameter list, right? And this is a symmetry that's actually intended. We really exploit a symmetry or an analogy between tuples and tuple types and parameter lists, right? So they both have sequences, positional sequences with types for each element, and they both have names that are kind of useful, but not essential to the consumption experience. Okay, so it's kind of a similar thing, and similarly for tuple literals, we kind of think of them in an analogous way to argument types. So they're the arguments that go into the tuple type. And so you can actually also have named arguments. So I could use a named tuple element. So I can use the same syntax as I use for named arguments to also create a tuple that has names here. You notice it has different names than the other one, and the compiler's happy. Now, you can change the names all you want. They're just this compiler helper thing. We're not going to stop you from doing it. So now I'm going to actually implement the method. I'm going to introduce a local variable. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do it manually because demo bits. So, oh, wow, what happened there? Var, let's call it.
Not that far.
R equals, wow. This is what you get when you work in DemoBit. So I'm actually introducing, I'm having a temporary variable here that's the tuple, and now I'm going to for each over my list and compute the sum and the count here. So let's for each var v in the list and do something. And the something we do is, so let's take, wow. Let's take
Nobody's ever used that type. S-byte?
S-byte. Why is it even there?
Yeah.
What were we thinking? OK, so I can access r.s here because I gave it a nice name. But one thing to notice is that I'm actually, so I'm going to update the tuple as I go along as an accumulator. But I'm actually updating it field-wise. So so it's actually a mutable field here in the tuple. r.s plus equals the v. And let's also increment the count there, plus plus. Those members are just fields. They're public fields, and they're mutable. Why isn't that terribly bad? You know, concurrency, shared state. Why isn't the world going down here? Well, because tuples are structs. They're value types, and so you're not actually sharing them, right? It's just a local with two parts to it, and so this is totally fine. It's useful. It's also more efficient than if they were read-only. So people who tell you that tuples should be read-only, well, they're not supposed to. They shouldn't in C#.
So we're not using the tuple type that's in the framework.
We're not using the tuple type that's in the framework, which is a reference type. And therefore, it's very important that it's immutable. Otherwise, you easily end up sharing state through the tuple that things can go wrong. We are introducing a new underlying tuple type. It's kind of very similar, except that it's a struct and it's mutable. I actually have the source code for it here. I'm not going to show it to you for time. So that's tuples. You like them? Yeah, good. Actually, a few more things to note about them. This is a real type expression, right? So if I wanted my method to be async, async, come on. Async methods, it's even harder for them to return multiple results today because they can't have out parameters. But you can have a task of a tuple type. And you can just do it like this. Now you have an async method, returns a task of tuple, and I waited there. Yeah. The tuple comes back out.
That
right?
Looks like TypeScript.
With the names and everything, right? Because the compiler tracks it through. Now, it doesn't want me to await because I'm in a non-async method.
That's why it doesn't want you to type async there. You should file that bug.
Yeah,
I should file it. Doesn't like you to type it
inside. Yeah, can you do that from stage, please?
Yeah.
OK, so but let's not. Keep it async here. So another thing I just quickly want to mention is that because tuples have value equality and a value-based hash code, so when you compare them equals, they just compare their elements equals. And that means they're great for keys in dictionaries, for instance. Whenever you want a dictionary that has multiple keys, like I want a key both by H and name or something like that, you just put a tuple type in there as a key, and everything works out. Like when you look up by name and H, give it another tuple with those two in. Those compare equal and have the same hash code, and everything just works out. So now you have a super simple way of having multiple keys for dictionaries. They're just great for many, many things. Just little transport types, kind of transient. OK, enough about tuples, you think?
I think so.
OK.
Yeah, that was a lot about tuples.
That was a lot, yeah, OK, sorry. Another thing I want to talk about, pattern matching. That's actually on your machines there. It's a feature that's in flight. Some of it is there, some of it is not there yet. I'm going to show you the part that's there. So let's take the surprise. So let's take the numbers and generalize them a little bit here. I'm going to comment out these. I'm going to need it later. But I'm actually going to extend the example a little bit here to an object array because I want to now work with recursive lists and I want to do it in a really dirty way. So I'm just using object arrays. And kind of saying that a recursive list here of numbers is just one that its elements are either ints or they're object arrays, sort of by convention.
You're a horrible person.
Isn't that bad?
Wow. That's like a Cards Against Humanity play. It's
yeah,
terrible.
Right? I'm going to make you look at it for quite some time, too. So, of course, now that I made it an object array, I can't call tally anymore because it takes an int array, but I can change that. But when I do, I can't add v anymore here because it's not known to be an int. So we've got to check if it's an int and then only do this if it is.
It really is like JavaScript.
What's that? Yeah. Oh, come on.
You're just taking all the types away.
Maybe I spent too long in TypeScript after all. Okay, so let's take the V and check if it's int. Okay, that's what you do today. And then, okay, I checked. Now I forget all about it, and then I have to go and cast V again to int, because otherwise I still can't do anything with it. Except that now you can put an I here. You can declare a new variable as you go. I'm checking it's an int. I'm giving it the name I as an int, and then I can just add that int here. Scott showed that as well. The interesting part here is that this is not just like a nifty extension of the is operator. The thing that we have here is a new kind of thing in C# called a pattern. Okay, so some languages, functional languages, have pattern matching. And this is sort of a foray into that. So a pattern is something that, you know, you can take a value, and it can both test the value to see if it fits the pattern or not, if it matches it. And it can also, as it does so, if it matches, it can extract information from it into fresh variables that you can then use in scope of where you know the pattern to match. Okay? That's pretty powerful, control structure, really. So we took patterns and we integrated them with the is expression. We have more complicated patterns that I can show you in a bit. But we also have more places where you can use patterns. So the other one that works in this prototype is that, if I was going to, imagine I was going to go on here and say else if, and then do the same thing, v is enumerable of object, blah, blah, blah. You'll notice that all the if conditions are about asking some question of v. So this is more like, it isn't here. But that's because I put the else if in the wrong place. But it doesn't matter, because I'm going to delete it anyway. And
I can't imagine how you lost your space and your spot and all of that.
Do it in a different way. So the thing that would be nicer to do is, since we're examining V all the time, why don't we just switch on it? So if we turn this into, instead, a switch, let's say switch on V. And now I realize my code was wrong all the time, because I forgot to have curlies around the logic there.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for not. Thanks for nothing, bro.
You're welcome.
Let's go and put some curlies in there for the switch. Now, in my case, so I can, first of all, I can switch on anything now, not just the primitive types. I can switch an object or whatever I like. And my case statements can be, thank you. They can be much more interesting than just constants. For instance, I can take that pattern from before. Wow, what is wrong here?
It's all my fault. I haven't implemented any of these features in IntelliSense
yet. And I can use patterns for my cases. I can say, if V is an int, call that I. And under this case block here, I can use I. Let's see if I can format this better. I can use I in there. But if, on the other hand, it's an I enumerable of object, then I can use this case instead. I can call it L colon. And we could do things the other way, which is to, what do we actually want to do here? This is where we want to call the tally recursively. So let's say tally of L here. And then we can update in a different way. We say r.s should be incremented with the sum that was in there. And r.count should be updated with the count that was in the recursive count of the list, right? Does that sound right to you? They clap because they think it's a new feature.
They're not sure they understand all the code you're writing. It's very obfuscated.
It is. Do you think it's obfuscated? I think it's pretty clear.
I think it's very pretty, actually.
I think it's pretty. This is a type switch, right? We have a type switch in the language now. But it's not a new. It's not a new kind of switch. It's just the old switch that's been generalized. So if I want to, for instance, I want to handle nulls gracefully, I can still have a case null, which is just a constant. And we could say, well, for nulls, we're just going to skip them. We're not going to count them. We're not going to add them. Because now it's an object array. It can have nulls in there. I can actually, let's say I don't want to do all the tallying if that list is empty anyway. So I could do, I only want to do this when l.any. Okay, so I can call the any method on it. So I can now have conditions as well in my case clauses here.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Now, of course, I still need to. Now, I'm just passing through all the serial length lists that, of course, there's going to be a lot of. So I have to remember to have another case here for enumerable of object, which I can. But in this case here, Because cases are no longer disjoint like they were in the old days, they were just constants, they're all different. Now we actually need to define an evaluation order for switches. So we go top to bottom, just like we do with catch clauses, right? So we go top to bottom, and that means that if we get here, we know that it was empty because otherwise we would have caught it up here. Mm. And so I can just fall through to the case that null has there, like you can fall through always, and so on. I should probably also put a default in there saying, you know, throw if the whole thing was not well structured, but I'm not gonna for time. So that's some various ways that you can use pattern. Those are existing places in the C# language where patterns show up. And that's kind of how we try to do it. We take this concept from another language, but we try to massage it in so it feels natural with the structures you have, control structures you have, rather than inventing new ones, right? That's trying to make it keep the C# feel while being more versatile. I said you could also have more fancy patterns. I'm going to show, yeah. I pre-wrote some code here just to not spend too much time on it. I have a little class hierarchy, students and professors derived from person. I have some people here, some students. David Stevens is very new. He doesn't have any grades yet.
Yeah, you just gave me good grades. It's good. It's way better than my grades really were.
Yeah, I actually went and looked them up.
Yeah.
No, this is you. Oh, I flipped them. Oh, sorry. Yeah,
ooh,
okay.
Yes.
So what you can see is, again, I'm using the is operator. The is expression here to do a pattern match, but I'm doing a little more this time. I'm checking if it's a, I'm going over them, I'm checking if it's a professor. Okay, so far so good, but instead of just giving that professor a name, I am going into the properties. I'm using what I call a property pattern. So I go in and say, okay, take the subject and apply this pattern to it. Well, that pattern just captures whatever the subject is. So that's really just grab it into a variable, but don't put any conditions on it. Take the first name, and apply this pattern to it, and that's a constant pattern like you know from switches already. That's doing pure checking. It's not capturing anything, but it's checking that the name is Scott. And so the whole pattern only applies if there's a professor named Scott. And if it does, then I can grab his subject and print it out. And that's a lot of people called Scott, so I think that's still a pretty broad condition here. So this is an example, and you notice the last name is not even mentioned. I can just talk about the properties that I want to here. Mm-hmm. Here's another example with a student. It's kind of similar. I'm grabbing their first name without further conditions. I'm grabbing their GPA, but instead of saying var g, I'm saying decimal of g, because GPA is actually in there as a nullable decimal, because David doesn't have any grades yet, and we don't want to divide by zero. I'm actually filtering on only the ones that have a GPA, the non-null GPA, because they have grades. And so that would only print out Dustin to me. Yeah. Okay? Now I'm done with pattern matching. I'm almost done with everything I want to show. So there's one more feature that I can show briefly, which is probably more a bit of a low-level feature. It sort of completes the ref parameters by ref that you already know all the way back to C# 1.0. This is where I want to go back to using numbers that are, let's actually delete a bunch of stuff here. How far do we want to go? All the way down. There we go. I want to use the old numbers. I like the old numbers better. So let's uncomment that and not delete them. And let's now write a helper method. I'm not going to make it a local method, though I could, that we call find. That the idea is that I want to find an element in the array that fulfills a certain predicate. Okay, but I don't want to just get the value back. I want to get the element itself. I want to point into it so that I can mutate it. Maybe the predicate is one that tells me which ones I should change. And so the only way I can do that is to return an int. That's the index that points into the array. So that's quickly implemented. It's beautiful code. I know you'll like it. I'm taking an int array here list, and I'm taking a func from int to bool, and let's call that the predicate. And so this is how I'm going to implement it. Let's have an I here. That's the index. Let's do a for loop where we start out by being 0, and then we'll say as long as the predicate isn't true on the list of I, keep going, like this. Isn't that the most beautiful code you've seen, Dustin? Yeah. You liked the one before? And I'm just going to return I here. So if I go over the edge, it's going to go over the edge. It's going to throw an exception. Who cares? OK, I implemented it. It's demo. So the problem is, if I call this method define method, well, I get this index back, and then every time I want to do something with a cell, I kind of have to look it up. I kind of have to index again with it. I say numbers of I, numbers of I, numbers of I. And so if I was passing things by ref, I could just pass an array memory cell, and I could manipulate it nicely just as a variable. I could just assign into it and read from it and so on. And so the thing that is kind of missing is to kind of flip it around and allow you to return refs instead of just allowing you to pass them. So I can have a ref return. And this is a bit of a low-level. Again, many of you will never use this, but I'm going to show it anyway. It's kind of nifty. So I can return a pointer into, essentially a pointer into somewhere where there's an int variable. Okay, I'm saying ref int. So now I have to return a ref. I'm returning a ref to the, it's not actually letting me return a ref to this local here, because that would, it's smart enough to figure out that that's off the stack by the time it gets back. So it's disallowing that. But I can return a ref to the list of I here. And that's like passing list of I by ref to a parameter, to a
you don't
method.
Capitalize it.
Just the other way around. What's that?
Don't capitalize it. You'll be better.
Oh. I'm blaming.
If you press tab and let IntelliSense work for you, it does.
No, I'm blaming the IDE.
Just saying. It's totally a new feature. I know. It's hard to use.
So now I get this thing back. I can say int, and I can say int r equals, but now it's actually going to dereference the thing that comes back and just give me the int that was in that place. Instead, I can say ref here to keep the reference that was passed back to me, and then I can hold that in a ref local. So now I have something that
you haven't passed the predicate. I debug your code for you, Mads.
Thank you. That's why I bring you here.
I know. Yeah. That's clear.
So let's grab the one that is the first one that's greater than 4.
Cool.
And now it should work, right? So what I now have is a pointer into the array at the first place where something is greater than 4. So it actually, I have that variable, I have that storage location in R.
Now, the interesting thing, Mads, is that normally if you wanted to do this sort of thing, you just said you had a pointer to something. It's the sort of thing you do with unsafe code, right? And here, this is not unsafe.
Right. So if I take what's inside of R, dereference it implicitly here, then that should be equal to the thing that's inside of the fourth element there, probably, if I count it correctly. And so we could print that out and check that those two are indeed equal.
Numbers.
Man.
And a following curly.
Yes. Anything else?
No, that was good.
Okay. Now I'm going to update, I'm going to mutate that thing. So, and then we're going to take and write it out again. So if we look here quickly, the idea is they both point to the same place in the array. Mutating one should also mutate the other, just to prove to you that it's the same storage location. And so while it does that, that's all that I have to show that's actually implemented. That totally didn't work at all. So it's probably a... There's clearly an off by one here, it was probably number 3 instead there. But anyway,
sorry,
close enough.
I can't do it all for you, man.
Can't do it all. Okay, can you flip me back to slides?
I can flip you back to slides.
Okay, I actually lied before. There's one more slide. You saw these things. You have the clicker.
I do.
We're also talking about a few more things. We'll see if they make it in this time. Otherwise, they'll make it in next time. So we're talking about something like records that are really an abbreviation of classes to represent data. So if you want to have immutable data with value equality and all the defaults of C# are against you, but maybe you could have some syntax like this here that that really extends to all this code. It writes all this code for you in order to have just class-based things that are immutable and value-based. Okay, so write little value classes very simply, just to carry data around. We're thinking about allowing you to use object initializers on immutable types as well, making it easy to use immutable types in general. There's a little issue about it's easy to come up with syntax for this, but how does it actually get the values in? Now we're still struggling with that. We also, importantly, when you're working with immutable data, the way you do it is often that there's sort of records of a given point in time, and you still want to mutate, you still want to create a chain, you still want to change them, create a later state of the world, but you do it by creating a new one that looks like the old one, except for things changed. And we're thinking about a language feature to support that first class, where you could take the value that's in P1, and you can get one that's just like it, except with a few things changed, that you give in kind of an object initializer syntax. But other than that, I think we're pretty much done with C# 7. So hopefully there's something in there you can use. Yeah? Over to you.
I'm going to start on this side. That side? No. We'll start over here. All right. So I want to talk to you guys a little bit. I'm going to show some Visual Studio Code integration and what we've been working on there. This isn't amazing, but it just shows that it really actually works. Because you know we've had a C# extension in Visual Studio Code for a long time now, and it targeted MS Build projects and also the DNX projects of yore before they made it into .NET Core and all of that. And that's all still baking. So right now we're kind of chasing after that and making sure that the extension that we have there is pretty good. And we actually, Visual Studio Code used to ship with a C# experience inside of it already. It no longer does after it released its extensibility model and its gallery for extensions last November's Connect. Since then, we've taken the C# extension out of there and we put it on the gallery. And I'm happy to say that we did this, about 4 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I'm happy to say that it rapidly became the number one most popular extension for Visual Studio Code is to do C#. Okay, which thrills me because number two was kind of sort of a rival of mine.
So you're kind of bragging about bullying all the little ones here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So, anyways, I've got here. I've done .NET new. I've got the .NET core .NET CLI version, the beta, 1598. That's the one that's released publicly right now. It's not one of the kind of bleeding edge versions of that. And I'd already created in here a .NET core project. Okay, and so it's just a simple Hello World kind of app. I'm going to bring up Visual Studio Code, open it up in there, and what you're going to see in very, very small font, my apologies for that, but you will see down here, you'll see things light up, and that's because of the OmniSharp server that hosts Roslyn, and also that we've been updating and working with those guys to update to support .NET Core. Okay, so it provides, up here you see things like Code Lens appearing and Find All References working. If I type in here, you'll get IntelliSense and all of that. And so this is all coming through Roslyn. This is the extension itself is written in TypeScript, but it communicates with OmniSharp over standard I/O. But we also, in this extension that we released something kind of extra special, mostly for those that kind of wanted to go kind of take the extra step and dig in. We introduced debugging for Core CLR, .NET Core-based Core CLR apps. And so I can actually F5 this app. It compiles with the .NET CLI, comes in, and it should hit a breakpoint. Yes, it hit a breakpoint. And when I step, you see the values, the locals update over here, and you see our names and that sort of thing. So just more of a showing that this stuff is actually coming, it's actually working. Some of these things we're trying to get out, we're trying to get .NET CLI and .NET Core to a good state here shortly, in the coming weeks, and we'll have this extension out targeting .NET Core right along with that. So in the next couple of weeks. So let's move over to Visual Studio 15. 15 in quotes preview, not Visual Studio 2015. Sorry for the confusion.
No, it's completely different.
Again. We do this every time.
We have to not ship every year.
We should wait 3 years to ship. Or we should start shipping every 3 months. I'm not sure what you guys want more. Now, I want to show a few things in here. As I said, I have the Franken build to end all Franken builds in here of all sorts of features I grabbed from various places. And then it was like the team's like, well, it doesn't actually build with Visual Studio 15 yet, so you need to go cherry pick some commits from this. It was a mess. It was my day yesterday I spent on that. But I got some things working, and a few of these things are here. You may have seen some of them, and some of them, I guarantee I have a demo you have not seen it build. And I have bits that have not been shown here. So the first thing I want to talk about, though, is something that we built last week. Seriously, last week we built this. We decided, you know what? Let's go ahead and do it. It'll look cool. People will like it. We can put it in Amanda's demo. That went well. And the idea, it did. It went very well. And so the idea that we now, as you're typing in IntelliSense, we will highlight the span that matched, that actually matched the characters. Because sometimes it's just crazy what it matches, right? You're like, how did that get in there? And it's good to kind of see so you can kind of teach yourself what's actually happening, right? So if I type, and I'm doing camel case matches, you'll see the bolding show up on the correct characters. I hope that's visible up there. I'll make it a little bit bigger.
That's cool.
Yeah, there we go. It's a little better. IntelliSense didn't really grow that well. But another piece that's on there, and that's kind of cool, that we added as part of this as well, and seriously, we did it last week. The editor team checked in an API. We took the bits. We made it work. And that's these filter icons down here. right? Very often I'm working with some object, some type, and you know, I'm like, especially in this case, I'm like, oh, Mads, why did you have to do link? What isn't an extension method on
all
this
those extension
anymore,
methods.
Right? And so if I just want to see the properties and the methods, I can do that pretty easily and get back to what the instance stuff is, right? And I can filter down. Yeah. And for my next trick, I want to show a few things. And that's like magic bits. I hope we get that into, you know, our next release of Visual Studio 15. That's the plan right now. So post preview when we do the next one. Now I want to show a couple of things that are kind of in features we've been doing, because we've been trying to fill out this inner loop experience. We want to make this super pleasurable for you guys, right? You should be coding in C# and like saliva should be coming out of your mouths and dripping all over the keyboard, because it's fun and it's exciting it's just like, I got it, okay, stopping. Stepping back from the metaphor again, okay. And so one of the things I want to show is we've done a lot of improvements to add using. You know, add using, when you type a type name and you hope you typed it right, and then if you typed it right, you press control dot and it'll add the using when you press enter, and if you didn't type it right, it'll generate a new type for you because we can't read your mind and you should type better. That one. We've made it so that you don't have to type as well. Sort of, I mean, you still need to look. So often I'm trying to type it, I'm doing that exact same thing, I'm typing the type and I just completely blew it, right? I spelled it wrong. And so with update 2 of Visual Studio 2015, so this is actually in, you know, bits that aren't totally totally fresh. We'll go ahead and run a spell check algorithm on that, and then go against all the types we've indexed everywhere, and offer you usings for things we think they are, and then we'll correct the identifier in the code for you if you choose that one. So if I look right here, you can see that, okay, yes, I actually meant to type XML document, and it'll grab it from using system, or if I picked using system XML link, it would insert X document for me, right? So helping us spell check on these things. Now, and this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm gonna. But you've probably seen that one, okay? I get that you might have seen that one.
I could have used that before.
You could have used that. There's also a feature in Visual Studio called copy paste, so you don't have to type it all.
Oh, okay.
It's new, this release. It's actually only in preview bits.
Okay.
So
talk to you later.
I'll show you later.
Let's take this offline.
Okay. Another feature with add using, and again, it's something that we haven't really talked about all that much, but there's a lot of cool stuff in here. It's getting way better. Let's say I want to new up a person. I've got a person type. It's in a project, but I failed to reference that project. I have a project over here on the right called Super Helpful Helper Library, and it is not in fact referenced by the console app that I'm in. So, and I've also typed the person type wrong. But if I press Control Dot, it goes ahead and it says three things it's going to do. First, it's going to add a project reference for that project to my current project. It'll fix the identifier to match person, and it will add the using for me. Right? And so then I can go on my merry way and new up my good friend, my colleague.
See, oh, thank you.
He'll see if I can spell his name right again. All right. I do. I spell your name correctly.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. All right. Now, another piece here, and we've seen this one before. You guys have seen this one here before, but it's kind of like the crowning moment on add using. And it's something that is actually not on by default in Visual Studio 15. So you'll go and grab the preview and try it out and go, hey, this doesn't work. It's actually hidden under a reg key right now because it wasn't quite ready for prime time, but it's totally ready for demo prime time. But that's the one to add a NuGet package, right? So suppose I wanted to use a type like immutable array. Well, I type that in, I question dot. I don't actually have the package, but if I press control dot, it will say, hey, yes, I can add the using for you, and I can add the package. And this project doesn't have a packages.config, so it'll add the packages.config, it'll make the reference happen, and it will undo properly. So, you know, when you're in, like, if you're in a console app like this, or if you're in a WinForms app, or something that targets .NET framework, and you're not really using NuGet yet, it's like a major thing to go down, right? Because now you've got the packages config, and it can make a mess of things if you realize, ah, that's not what I wanted to do. So we made sure that undo works, and it pulls out the packages and config if you're like, whoa, hey, that's not what I wanted. And so that whole experience is there as well. All right. The question was shouted out, what's the flag? And I will not give you crazy flags to edit into your registry from stage. But we'll try and get that out to you. So if people that really want to try it out and play with it and, you know, and give us feedback, We'll make sure that's out there for you. And if it doesn't get out there, it's dustin.campbell@microsoft.com, and you can yell at me on email. You can send it all caps and everything. All right. So let's switch over to a different project. I want to talk about a couple of other things that have already shipped. When we ship features like this and we improve the inner loop in updates, they don't get as much fanfare as maybe if we shipped in a major version. So I want to share a story with you about this code base a little bit. You know, when I come to a big code base, I want to find out things about it. And so I start looking at interface and saying, who'll implement these interfaces? And in Visual Studio, finding out who implemented something in a C# code base is a major pain in the neck, right? Because you come to it and it's like, well, find all references, I guess. That'll eventually show me who implements it, I suppose. And so I come in and, wrong key. Come in. And I say, well, let's do final references. And that shows me 32 references to this thing. And somewhere in there are the actual classes that implement this interface, right? And so in this release, we decided to go ahead and update one. We decided to go ahead and add a feature we've been meaning to add for years, which was go to implementation. Right, so this works great if you're on an interface, if you're on an interface method and you want to find out who implements it, if you're on an abstract method and you're inside a method body and you want to know where's the override, who's got it, and you want to navigate there really quickly. In this case, we added it in update one, but we didn't add a keyboard shortcut for it because we're just mean. And so you had to like come in and right click and make it happen. But we did add a keyboard shortcut in update two, and it is in fact control F12. Okay, so control F12 in a C# project or a VB project will in fact find you the implementers of an interface or an override, that sort of thing. All right. I'm coming over to a file, and if you look at the scroll bar, there's all sorts of warnings in this file. And that's because as part of this Visual Studio 15, with the preview, we've introduced a whole kind of system around code style. And we're really going to try and go after this thing that is common in every single IDE except for Visual Studio, right? The ability to say, my team has a particular coding style, and it's more than just where my braces go. It's also about how I name my methods. You know, it's about how I, want to use the language, whether I want to qualify things, all those sorts of things. And for us, as we're building out this whole refactoring and fix, code fix story, it's really important because we want you to be able to specify the style that we generate things in. We don't want you to, hit control dot and generate a method and have to go change it immediately to fix up all the stuff that we did by default that you couldn't control, right? But we also want to, stay true to the analyzer story and make sure that these things are enforceable. So when you do, you can specify the things I want the style to look like, but also enforce that for me. I want this to, and when I don't do this, make it a warning, that sort of thing. And so there's a new options dialog. There's a new options page that shows code style. And you've seen some of this in other talks, but we took some of the code style options that we put into Visual Studio 2015 and we made them more granular and put more options into them, more ways that you can specify, for this dot, I want to qualify, because I like to qualify, for example, fields and properties with this dot, but not necessarily other things, right? Just the things that look like data, for example, is a style I have. Now, I want to, in the sake of time, I want to move on to naming styles and naming rules, because this is a place where we want to spend a bunch of time, we're going to spend a bunch of effort. Right now, I've got a rule here. This is super configurable, where I can decide I want to have rules that target various different types of symbols. Like I can say I want a rule that handles classes and structs and ensures their names look like this when the tick count on my machine is even or something. You can do things like potentially we would like to be able to do that level of enforcement. But I'm not going to dig too deeply into this, but it is in the preview. So try it out. We want to take it much further. Where today this is globally scoped, this configuration for these styles is global. We want to make that more granular. We want to be able to have an asset that you carry along with the project or with, be able to specify configurations for a folder of files. So I could say that my behavior-driven tests, I always like to be all lowercase with underscores for the test methods, that sort of thing. So that's a place we want to go. And when we go there, not just in Visual Studio, I'd like to take that also into VS Code and wherever you want to write C# code, so long as those assets are with the project, whatever that looks like, whether it's editor, config, or something else, we want to support that. So one last demo. because we're almost out of time. And it's an awesome demo. And I just set expectations, didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we get a request an awful lot. And it goes something like this. It says, you know, it'd be really great if you would do something about notify property change. You know, we really hate this. And you guys are really smart, and the compiler's smart. You did Roslyn, right? Can't you do this notify property change thing? And when it comes down to it, you know, it's an awfully specific pattern to bake into the compiler knowledge of. You know, and so that's what we tell you when you ask that. And you walk away mad. You don't buy us the beverages we were hoping you'd buy us.
Yeah, I've said it many times.
Because they say, no, but really, can't I, you know, just type this right here and put an attribute and make that work, right? And, you know, if you press control dot, the answer is no, but there's a lot of other packages, NuGet packages, that do implement that, and you could use them. We're not going to use one of those, but there, in fact, this is such a problem that there are many, many frameworks for doing this. So I'm going to go ahead and generate this type, and then I'm going to do something a little magical. Okay, I'm going to search on NuGet for a package. Now you've seen before, and you probably saw it in Scott Hunter do this today with FXCOP analyzer rules, being able to go to NuGet and pull down a package and have it bring down smarts that add in diagnostic analysis and code fixes right into the IDE. Well, I want to do something like that. What's this called? Build shenanigans. See if it's might not actually have been indexed. That's okay. I can use my magic code. We'll just go grab it. Super helpful library. Super helpful helper library. Okay, so I'm going to bring up the package count console.
You have a minute.
I know. I totally got this.
Okay.
It's fine.
All right.
PowerShell ever starts up, it'll be fine. Oh dear. If PowerShell, I totally jinxed it. Oh, there it goes. Oh, thank God.
There it is.
Okay. Woo. Let's paste this, and now, of course, the internet will work.
Yeah.
So this will be fine.
Yeah. Go.
Oh, good. It was fine.
Yeah.
All right. So. Now, what I want to happen, like, it would be great, wouldn't it be great if, you know, adding that attribute over there, if I could come over here and come to the next line and then type p dot and get, like, property change to show up in there and just see it kind of magically happen. It didn't happen, right? The reason it didn't happen is because I didn't build yet. So what I've done is I've pulled in magical things that came through NuGet, right? So this is the sort of thing a library could couple with it, just like analysis. And now property changed is in fact there. And we have done source code generation on the side. So I'm just gonna set this and we'll F5. And you can see what's happened here. I'm gonna take just probably 2 minutes over to describe what's going on.
You guys can handle it.
I know it's
now.
Late and I know you guys are like blood sugar low, having not eaten dinner yet. All right, so, whoops. Oh, I actually have to change a property. Duh, thank you, sir. I'm not going to leave it as Dustin Torgerson.
Aw.
It is our spring fling here,
yeah,
but at the conferences. But
all right, okay.
Okay, so F5, it builds. And what's happening here is that just like an analyzer, there's analysis going in. And an analyzer, diagnostic analyzer, can contribute diagnostics, either warnings or squiggles, based on that analysis. But what we're doing is we're doing analysis that instead of generating diagnostics, generates more code. Right, and so we have a partial part here with person that implements iNotify property change, and then there's a hidden brand new language feature, and I mean hidden and new in the sense that we wrote it last week, which is called replace and original. At least that's the name of the keywords. We don't really have a name for the feature.
Yeah.
I've been calling it sideways overwriting, because what this is in a partial type, I can say this declaration here replaces the one that it looks exactly like. So the compiler will compile to that one, and then I can reference the original declaration with original. Okay, so I can get back at that original property and get its value out and set its value with original keyword up there. And that's kind of how we can make this work. So you can have this kind of sideways sort of override on the side that makes this happen.
So what you did is you downloaded a generator.
Yeah.
That generated source code that wraps around the source code that the user wrote.
Exactly.
The logic to do the notify property change.
That's
pretty nifty.
Cool.
Thank you.
So
we're totally out of time.
Yeah, we're totally out of time.
So we're going to have to say Thank you very much for coming at this late hour, for staying an extra minute.
Thank you so much.
Looking forward to seeing you next year.